Hey there, what's going on? At Verified, we just released an article titled, How to Choose the Right Football Program for You. We hit important topics like how to visit schools, the criteria that you would use for making a good choice, and understanding your financial options. You can check it out for free at verifiedathletics.com. Once you're there, you can click on the Verified Athletics Recruiting Academy. Thanks for tuning in and sharing. Thanks to you, our audience is growing. And please support the podcast by sharing it with people you know or using social media and getting it out there. You can also subscribe and rate it where you get your podcasts if you're enjoying it. So our guest today is Issa Abdul El-Qaddous. Issa was barely recruited out of high school, but he had a six-year career in the NFL as a safety. He's bright as hell, and he has a great story to share. So I was thrilled to have him on. Enjoy. All right, welcome. We got Issa here. Why don't you take a second and introduce yourself?
I'm Issa Abdul El-Qaddous. I'm a former NFL player. I played 6 years in the NFL, 3 years with the New Orleans Saints, 2 years with the Detroit Lions, and 1 year with the Miami Dolphins.
That's awesome.
Former Fordham Ram, graduated in 2011, played 4 years there. From Union, New Jersey.
Well, sweet. And what's like the most memorable thing of your experience from growing up to high school to college to NFL football? What really sticks out to you when you like look back at your career?
Mostly it's teammates. My favorite year was 2001, actually. We played Pop Warner and we actually went to the national championship. We played like 17 games. We ended up losing the national championship game, but we went to Florida, you know, had an experience in Disney for a week, and that was amazing just because, you know, we bonded as a team so much better because we had so much time together and we played a lot of meaningful games. So, you know, I have a lot of friends from that time period that I'm still close with to this day.
And did you play with those guys all the way through high school, or was it just that team and then you ended up splitting up?
Most of the guys I played with throughout high school, I think probably about half. A couple of them like stopped playing and did like different things, but probably like half the team played high school with me.
Okay, and were you like the best guy on the team back then, or do you not even think of it that way?
I honestly never thought about it like that, but I mean, now like I'm kind of talking to, you know, people from my past, like I grew up with, parents and stuff like that, and it was pretty clear that I was better than everybody.
I would imagine that's probably true for most guys that played in the NFL, that they stood out in Pop Warner and then high school and college. I mean, you know, just kind of as you keep going up and up, you know, you stand out a little bit less, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's always tougher to stand out when you get to the higher levels because, you know, it's just the cream of the crop. Every layer, every level higher, you know, they take off the worst talent and add better people. So, you know, you always got to stay on your A game.
So, and then when was the last game that you played in the NFL?
2016, Christmas Eve, actually.
Okay. And what are you up to now or thinking about doing next?
I got injured that game. I had a pretty severe nerve injury to my right arm where I'm still actually recovering from it. So since then, I've just been in recovery. You know, I had surgery last May to transfer different nerves to my arm so the ones that die can be regenerated and stuff. So I've been just trying to get my arm back in function.
And was it immediate to you right away when you got hurt that it was going to be pretty life-changing, or was it just a normal play where you were coming off the field a little banged up?
I mean, when I got hit, I actually like was paralyzed for a couple seconds, probably like 10 seconds. And then when I thought everything was okay, I tried to like lift up my body. And when I was ready to lift up, I thought my arm was like in a, like right next to my side in like a locked position kind of. And when I looked at my arm, it was laying dead flat on the ground. So, you know, I kind of figured that, wow, this is like a severe injury. But none of the doctors or the trainers knew anything about this because, you know, nerve injuries are pretty rare in football. So it actually took me about a month till I realized how severe it really was.
Yeah. And then when that hit you, what did you think, or how'd you react to that?
I mean, I was crushed because I feel like I was at the top of my game. When I got to the Dolphins, that was the first time I was ever paid to be a starter, where I was sketched in as a starter from day one. And we actually had a great year. You know, it was the first time the Dolphins made the playoffs since 2008, you know, and I was a pretty big contributor in that. And it really crushed me because, you know, I felt like I was building towards something. And then, you know, I had to start all over again. So, you know, I was messed up for a long time.
And to me, it feels like, you know, I'm sure your story is unique in its own way. But in a lot of ways, I imagine it matches what a lot of players in the NFL experience, is that a career is on the rise and it's going well, and then one injury can derail things so quickly. Do you think that that's pretty common?
Oh yeah, definitely. I just think also just the detachment from football as well, you know, because we've been playing this game our entire lives, almost specializing in it, you know, because, you know, we went to school for certain things, but often most of the guys in the locker room kind of knew they was going to go to the NFL. So it's always tough for you to have this dream and specialize your entire life and use your whole education throughout your youth to be better at this thing. And then all of a sudden it's over and it's kind of empty, because that's like, sports is like one of the rare places where, well, especially football, where once you retire, you really can't play anymore. You know, like you can't just like go play tackle football games anymore. You know, it's just like one of the whole thing's over. You have to like detach yourself from it and start all over. So I think that's the thing that a lot of the players have in common, is starting over at like 30 or like 25 or something, you know. So it's a lot of you know, issues with that. I think a lot of people deal with that. And I learned that through, like, you know, talking to different players and understanding I wasn't the only one feeling this way.
And do the players that are playing before that moment happens to them, is it like something that's going on in the back of people's heads? Or are they not even thinking about it? Or I don't know. What do you think about that?
I mean, I feel like every injury you see, like practice in the game, puts everything in perspective, you know, because you realize, damn, like, you don't know the severity. Every time you see somebody on the ground, you think like, damn, I hope he's okay. He could come back. So I think that it's always looming in the back of your mind of that, you know, you are literally one play away and like nobody's exempt, you know? So I think that it's always there, but I don't think it's like, it like really like controls you, because, you know, everybody gets locked into the game and competing, you know, playing football.
Yeah. So it's like, seems like that there's like a fear that is ignored. You know, it's like you get reminded of it when you see someone go down, but like otherwise you like put it in the back of your mind, because it probably would paralyze you from being able to do the job that you're doing.
Exactly. And you almost want to live like it can't happen, you know, because like when you play football, you kind of get into a superheroistic mindset. You kind of think, oh, I can do anything. Nothing can stop me. I'm the strongest thing out here. And like, the fact that you can actually get hurt kind of like ruins that feeling a bit, you know? So like, you kind of can't think about it, because you'll be a little too human on the field, which will leave you like kind of vulnerable to get hurt or have like, you know, play bad or something.
Well, there's a million reasons why I wasn't that good at football, but I think that was one of them. So I think that like, I couldn't silence that voice. And I see it actually, it's interesting. I see it of a lot of the kids that I've, you know, athletes, I should say, that I coached, is that some of them have the ability to ignore that voice and some of them don't. And it's a weird thing for me to think about, because I think of it as being a totally rational and reasonable thing that people should be considering when they're taking the risks that they're taking to play football. But at the same time, if you take those into account, it's just not going to be as good. And that's like a weird thing that I always struggled with as a coach to think about.
Yeah, football is one of the sports that teaches you have to be in the moment, you know? It's like, because it's dangerous as well as, you know, a game of strategy, you know, and reaction. So, like, the thing is, you know, it's oftentimes it's great to think and understand every angle of something, but football kind of teaches you to, like, trust your gut, you know what I mean? That's what I learned a lot in, like, through just playing and, like, dealing with that fear, because it's always going to be a fear, you know, like, especially I remember when I made the jump from Pop Warner to high school. I was like 145 my freshman year, and I played Pop Warner, and I remember all the guys that played high school football were telling me, oh, you're too little, you're not going to be able to play, you're not going to be able to do this, you're not going to be able to do that. So, you know, I had that doubt there, but I was afraid too, because these guys I'm playing are like 220. I'm used to playing guys that's 145 pounds, you know, 150 pounds. And now I get to go to the next level where these guys are 220, 230, as fast as me, maybe faster than me, or stronger than me, maybe better than me, you know? So it was like a looming thing that you kind of had to like just say, you know what, I can't think about what these other guys' strengths are. I just got to be able to do my mission and do my job.
And did you play varsity football as a freshman, or did it take you time to build up to varsity?
I played varsity as a sophomore. I played Pop Warner actually as a freshman.
Oh, really? And Union, you guys, that's like a pretty strong program, you know, at least from what I remember. sending a lot of guys to play college football, you know, winning a lot of games. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, historically we were great. The past couple of years, I mean, we haven't won many championships, but we've sent guys to college.
Yeah. And when you played, was the team pretty good?
Yeah, we went to the second round of the playoffs 3 years in a row and lost. But, I mean, we always had talent. We was pretty good.
Yeah. And then how'd you end up at Fordham? Tell me a little bit about your recruiting story.
Well, my recruiting story was kind of crazy. After my junior year, I had a really big junior year. I was like third team all state or something like that, defensive player of the year in my county. And, you know, my recruiting started picking up. I was playing middle linebacker at the time. But I was undersized. I was like maybe 185, 190 playing middle linebacker. And so as I start going out for recruiting, I have a lot of teams interested in me. I'm getting a lot of letters, you know, Big 12, SEC, you know, ACC, Big East at the time, and Big 10. And when I started going to like camps, it started like these coaches started visiting me. They started realizing, hey, this guy's small. Like he's not a middle linebacker that's going to be 220, 230. So, you know, I started getting a lot of people passing on me, and not many people see me transition into safety or defensive back or whatever. So I was actually as highly touted as I was, like kind of when it came to like the accolades through the media and, you know, even like through how I was getting interest from different schools, I didn't really have any like serious interest where I'm getting official visits or getting scholarship offers. The way I actually ended up at Fordham was kind of crazy. I was it was like a Thursday or something like that. And I'm like leaving lunch and I see the Coach Dawson, Matt Dawson, he was scouting our school at the time in the hallway with like three of my old teammates with a Fordham hat on. And, you know, I don't know anything about Fordham at this time. I never heard of it. And he recognized me in the hallway. Hey, you're Issa, right? And he's like, hey, come with me. I want to talk to you about Fordham and bring you in on a visit and stuff. So, you know, I come into the office and I end up coming on a visit maybe 2 weeks later or whatever. And, you know, that ended up being my only offer. And by like signing day, I ended up committing.
And at the time, Fordham, you know, Fordham's in the Patriot League. And at the time, Patriot League did not offer full athletic scholarships, but now does. So like, you said that you got offered, but what did that offer look like?
It was a need-based scholarship based on how much you can qualify for in financial aid. They give you the money based off of that.
I gotcha. So was that, you said that was like your only offer. So your only offer was a need-based non-scholarship school, athletic scholarship Division I AA school.
Yes.
And were other schools like recruiting you at that time, like saying that they wanted you, but like hadn't pulled the trigger, or was it that you just kind of like floating out there?
I was getting interest, you know, talking to scouts and stuff like that. But a lot of it seemed as if they were like, well, if this guy falls through, we might offer you. Or then I started getting like Rutgers and like, what was it? Maryland was telling me that I could be a preferred walk-on. And I wasn't really down for that. I'd rather go somewhere where at least I felt valued.
Yeah, and when Coach Dawson saw you, did he see you as a future safety or did he see you as a middle linebacker that was undersized?
I think he see me as a middle linebacker that was undersized because my freshman year, I played middle linebacker the entire year. I think their plan was to put weight on me, but, you know, that obviously didn't happen.
Yeah, like, you know, knowing you, I'm like thinking, I don't know how they're thinking that that's going to work. But, you know, there are some middle linebackers that can fly around and get some stuff done and not be the biggest guys in the world. But in college, you were hovering around 190, 200, you know, as a junior, senior from what I remember.
Yeah, I was. And I was about the same size I was, you know, playing linebacker. But I was I was pretty like nifty with it. You know, I kind of knew how to make it work for myself without having to like, you know, hit linemen and go through all that. But I wasn't going to have a long, healthy career if I stayed in the middle.
And so when did you end up getting to like move to safety? Whose idea was that? How did that come about?
It was the following year. And I believe it was I think it was Coach Masella, the head coach's idea to move me to safety because I was actually one of the faster people on the team at the time. And I just hurt my shoulder. I hurt my shoulder maybe the second or third game of the year where I had to get surgery on my torn labrum and get it fixed and stuff. So I guess for me to be in a less physical position, they decided to move me to safety because, you know, I had the skill set to do that as well.
Yeah, I think you're being a little self-deprecating when you say that you were one of the fastest guys on the team. I'd be very surprised if you weren't the fastest guy on the team or the conference at the time.
Yeah. I was. I had the school. I still got the school record at the in the 40.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah. That doesn't surprise me. What was your your 40 time for the NFL scouts on the pro day?
On the pro day, it was like 4.42. They had me scouted at or something like that.
And then, what was your fastest time that you ran? You know, for the Fordham guys.
Well, when the scouts came the first time my junior year, I ran 4.27, but it was on the track, so they kind of like you know, adjusted it for whatever. But that's the school record, 4.27, that that Fordham holds.
Yeah, and would you say that that's what puts you on the map for the NFL? Is that junior day time?
That junior day time, along with my Wonderlic score, because I actually did pretty well at the Wonderlic. And so, like, they what my agent was telling me, what Coach Marcello was telling me, that, you know, NFL scouts and NFL coaches, they love smart, fast guys. So, you know, that really put me on the map as a player that could transition to the NFL.
Yeah, and so for people that don't know, why don't you explain what the Wonderlic is?
The Wonderlic is, like, pretty much an IQ test for, like, football players. It's, like, 50 questions, and you get 10 minutes to answer the questions, and they only grade you from the number of questions you answer. And, you know, they kind of try to determine your learning capacity based on the test.
Yeah, and there's, like, a lot of, like, mathy, like, problem-solving type questions, right, from what I know. Could you give, like, an example of a test question that'd be on there? I don't really know one, but maybe you don't remember.
Like, the for example would be, like, if such and such has 5 apples and he gives 3 away, how many can he give away? It'd be like something that's like very open-ended. It's hard to, like, you know.
Yeah, it's like math word problems, like a lot of them, I think, right?
Yeah, it's just really trying to place things in the right position and make the equation to like figure it out.
Yeah, and none of the, from what I remember, like none of the questions in themselves are like that hard, but it's more of just how quickly can you answer those types of questions, right? Not so much like your ability to answer them given enough time, right?
Yeah, because you have 10 minutes. You have to just really like get through it. Like you want to get a higher score by doing more questions because you only have 10 minutes. But some of these questions will take you like, you know, a couple minutes to, you know, get through. But, you know, you got to either skip it or just fill in an answer. Because, like, you know, it's a little tough.
And did it surprise you when you scored well in the Wonderlic, or were you expecting that you'd score well?
I knew I was going to score well. I'm always good at stuff like that. I kind of get excited for those type of challenges and, like, tests like that.
Yeah, I bet there's a handful of guys that are dreading that test.
Yeah, a lot of people don't like it, you know. A lot of people don't even, you know, especially the guys that, you know, were projected to be top picks. They just sit through the test, maybe answer a couple questions, and don't really care.
Well, yeah, I mean, at a certain point, it's like if you're already projected to be top 10 or top 5 or something like that, like why would you give someone a reason to downgrade you?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So you did well in the Wonderlic, you ran fast, and that puts you in a unique category. I've actually been thinking about that a lot lately, and I think that's something that more people should focus on is, you know, there's a lot of things in the world that you're good at, right? But you're not the best at in the world. There's like, you know, hundreds or thousands or millions of people better than you at them, but you're still pretty good at them. Mm-hmm. And so in each individual thing, you don't stand out to be like the best in the world. But if you start adding some of those skills together, you know, you start getting into a place where, well, how many people have, in your case, like how many people have this level of speed? You know, there's faster people, but not that many people. And then how many people have, you know, good, quick thinking smarts, right? There's definitely people that are smarter than you or I, but you're still pretty good at it. But then when you start like crossing those two worlds, you come up with like a set of skills that makes you incredibly unique.
Exactly.
And doing that and thinking about that is like what makes you successful. And so in your case, I think it was those two things. I bet other things as well. But is that how you always thought about it? Is like these two things coming together?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I felt like I was never a guy that like was the top of the line at anything. I kind of would feel like I was a balance of many things, you know. And when you get to like the NFL, you kind of realize that a lot of people were just like extremely good at one thing their entire life. Like they were extremely strong. They were extremely fast. They were extremely tall and they jumped over people. You know, there was no tackle that could block them. They might have been 6'5", 270 their entire lives. And till college, they didn't really play a tackle that was over 250, you know? So like some guys are just like freakishly athletic and they live on those extremes, but they don't really try to like become a balanced, complete player, which makes you a great NFL star. You know, you try to incorporate all the weaknesses that you have and become more balanced instead of living on extremes of things, because that could get you in trouble.
And how do you go from being an undrafted free agent to getting picked up by an NFL team and then making a roster and then having a career? How does that happen? Like, that story usually ends with, I'm an undrafted free agent, I get invited to a rookie camp, and I'm out, and that's it. I was on the Steelers for 3 weeks, right? That's like, that's the typical story.
Yeah, I mean, mine was even crazier than that, because I was an undrafted rookie in the lockout year. So once the draft ended in, April, like, 30th, there was no communication between players and teams till, like, the end of July. So I missed OTAs, rookie minicamp, regular mini camp. So, you know, I was kind of behind the eight ball. But, you know, I kind of throughout the time when the lockout, you know, I just tried to train and stay in shape. And I was just telling myself, like, it was either this or I'm going to work a regular job, you know. So, like, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to at least show each team through the preseason games. And even in practice, I'm going to show y'all that I'm going to kill myself to go make this team. Like, I didn't care. You know, my whole mindset was, like, I'm going to do what it takes, because I knew it wasn't something that you needed a special skill set to do, because, you know, I've talked to a lot of pro athletes at the time, different guys that train guys. You know, it was more so of like understanding your routine and kind of understanding what it takes to be great, what you need to know, what kind of information you need to know, how much you need to study and stuff like that. So honestly, I took it in day by day, and, you know, it was tough at first, because in camp I was like the last guy on the roster, last safety on the roster. So most days I kind of wouldn't practice, and I would get special teams reps, and I would just, like, you know, run down and try to, like, show myself on that so I could get on the team and stuff. But once the preseason game started coming around, I didn't play, like, many, like, a lot of reps. But when I was out there, you know, I made myself known. Even if I didn't, like, make a play, I was going to be around the ball. So I just tried to make a name for myself as somebody that's going to fly around and become just, like, a little problem. Like, regardless if I'm doing the right thing or not, I'm going to be, like, in the mix of something, like, making something happen. And it ended up working out, and I ended up making a team. And we played the first game of the year, the Thursday night game against the Green Bay Packers. And I remember lining up in Lambeau Field, running down for the opening kickoff. I think it was crazy.
Yeah, that's the fun part about being, you know, at the bottom of the bottom of the roster, just making the team, is you're on special teams. And when the season starts, the first play goes, that's a special teams play. So you're out there.
Yeah, you like literally like start. You know, it's kind of crazy. It was surreal, you know, like under the lights in Lambeau, first game of the whole NFL season, the whole world's watching, you know, and it was like a crazy experience. It was like literally 5 weeks after like being in the Bronx, sitting in my room, you know, I was like out on the field in New Orleans, like, you know, on the team, like finding an apartment while I'm getting ready to play the Packers on Thursday Night Football.
And you were with the Saints at the time, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And so actually, I'm curious still a little bit more. I mean, now it's become HBO TV, you know, training camp. And so I think a lot of people are getting their taste of what that is like. I've always thought of it as like teams got 50 some spots, right? And 45 of them are basically spoken for, you know, like for the most part, you know who's going to fill those. And there's like 10 spots left and you got like 100 guys going for those last 10 spots. Is that how it feels?
I mean, when you start realizing you got to, like, you know, compartmentalize it and kind of make it, like, smaller. So, like, you kind of want to think about, all right, your position. And I always thought about, let me just be one of the better safeties in my position. Let me be one of the better players. Because if I'm one of the better players here, then I'm a whole value at that. Then if I'm better than the guys that's there, they'll say, okay, I trust this guy to come in and play if the starter gets hurt, you know. So it's I didn't really think about it as like, oh, I have to beat out people. I just said, look, I got to be the best player that I can be to let these coaches know that they could put me on the field and trust me. Because if I never allowed them to trust me, then there was no reason for them to keep me.
And then I imagine you form relationships during that time and guys get cut and they come and they go. Is that hard to see people, you know, I guess like seeing, I imagine it's like seeing people's dreams get crushed on a daily basis almost.
Yeah, they call it Black Friday, you know, when that Friday after the fourth preseason game, you know, you see guys cleaning out their lockers, and, you know, it's always tough and it's sad because some guys have a whole family down here and they got to move, pick up and move somewhere else. Like, you know, their whole family, and they don't have any help. Like, they just have to, they'll get phone calls from different teams and they got to just go wherever they get a workout. If they're in New Orleans and Green Bay calls them, they got to pick up and go to Green Bay and move their entire family, put the kids in school over there. You know, it's a really impactful on somebody's life when they just get cut. It's not just like, you know, just, oh, he's an NFL player. It's like, you know, you got to really move your entire life somewhere else.
Yeah. What do you think of fans when they have like a fan's perspective? And like, I hear it all the time that some player stinks, you know, like it's so absurd to me. That fans would have that perspective, because anyone that makes it to the NFL is ridiculously talented and good. What do you think when you hear that stuff?
I think that they just see black and white. You know, they don't really care about the little nuances of what happens behind the scenes and stuff. They only really care about results, which makes sense, you know. And whatever they see, they're going to, like, blame it on certain guys. And I think you just have to take it with a grain of salt, because the way I did was, like, I know all the things that go into a play, all the things that goes into somebody looking like they messed up, because sometimes they don't even mess up, you know? So, like, I just kind of say, you know, they're a bit uninformed on what really goes on, so they're just going to feel away for the sake of feeling away, and I can't be upset at them for not knowing, you know? So I don't really get too offended by it, because I know that they don't know. They're just really doing it for entertainment and not for, like, the, you know, the study and the seriousness that players do, and, you know, people that really, like, are in the organizational football.
So you think it's easy for you to ignore that stuff?
Yeah, because, I mean, they're not like experts. They don't know what's going on. They don't even know what plays is going on. You know, they just see what happens on TV and just blame somebody, you know, because something ain't work out in their favor. So, like, you know, you don't know what coverage they was in. You don't know if the coach told them to do that and somebody else is supposed to be there, you know. So it's just like, I mean, they're just going to be feeling away based off all the information they have. And if they don't have it all, then I really can't be mad at them for feeling a certain way about what they think happened.
Do you think that that's typical for NFL players to feel that way? Or do you think that they take it more personally sometimes?
Nah, guys take it very personally. You know, like people don't like hearing anything negative about them. So they'll, like, argue with guys that say they stink and that they were bad. And it's like, to me, it's like, you're really, like, stooping down to a level of something that you're not even, you know, that isn't even right. You're just sitting there arguing for the sake of arguing, you know? And it's like, you know, we watch film, your coach already told you what you did wrong and accepted the reason why you messed it up and everything's okay, but you still feel the need to go on social media and fight some guy that says you stink. You know, it's like, you kind of, like, it's a ego thing more than anything.
Yeah, I think it's also, like, it's a protection of a reputation, I think, at some level. You know, it's like, even when they know that they're right, you know, their reputation to them still matters. And so other people recognizing that they're right and seeing things correctly is important to them. I don't know if that's how it feels.
Yeah, but I mean, that makes sense. But I always thought, like, I mean, the only person that really matters when it comes to the perception of you is, you know, your coaches and your organization, because that's who's paying you. You know, that's the people that say you did a good job or bad job. Like, everybody else is just spectators in a sense, you know. Like, they don't really know what's going on. They don't affect your well-being, you know. So it's like, why would I really get up in arms about somebody that really has nothing to do with me?
Well, I think that mental strength that you have is pretty unique. It sounds like you think it is at the NFL level too. Do you think that was one of the things that brought you from Pop Warner in Union, New Jersey to NFL, you know, career?
I've learned a lot of this as well through, like, the top tier stars, you know, that, you know, I watch Drew Brees, he'll have a bad day and, you know, they'll talk about him in the media and say, oh, he's too old, he can't do it anymore. You know, I watch him just go to work. He don't care about what everybody else is saying. And, you know, like, throughout I was growing up, I kind of just looked at the game as just a game. I didn't really have, like, at high school, you know, we didn't have, like, thousands of people at our game. We had, like, family members, maybe some students, the band. So it wasn't like there wasn't much like, oh, Issa, why you do this? Oh, this guy sucks. Cause, like, nobody really cared. And it was kind of the same thing at Fordham, you know, like, nobody came to our games like that. And there was no, like, after the game on Saturday, people saying, oh, you gave up the game winning touchdown, you suck. They most of the time, they don't even know we played, you know? So I never really thought about the fans and how everybody else perceived my play, because nobody really cared about it until I got to the NFL. So, like, when I got to the NFL, I kind of, like, try to use this as, like, a, hey, let me clean my slate of everything I know about being a football player, because, I mean, I'm in a whole different place. And now these are the top of the tier athletes, the best football players out right now, you know, of all time, some of them, you know. Let me just try to pick up from what they, you know, what they, how they move, what's their routine, what they do. And, you know, oftentimes you see the guys that, you know, that are top of their game, they don't really like stoop down to what the fans are saying or how everybody else thinks of them or what reasons why they're not playing to the level they're not playing. They just go back to work and figure it out. And then all of a sudden it's a redemption story and it's, oh, he came back and resilient and he's great again. And, you know, it's just about keeping your head down and working and not really worrying about what everybody else is saying, knowing that the objective is to win a football game.
Yeah, the expression I think is it's never as bad as it seems and it's never as good as it seems. You know, when everyone's telling you how great you are, you're probably not that great. And when everyone's telling you how bad you are, you're probably not that bad and you're just kind of rolling along.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's really just about just staying in the moment. I remember I read a quote after Tom Brady's last Super Bowl win and Bill Belichick said like one of the best things about him was that he's able to put everything, whether good or bad, behind him and focus on what's exactly in front of him in the next obstacle in front of them, you know, and that's very important to never think that, oh, that last thing was so great, I could take this play off, or I'm so good, I don't got to practice tomorrow. You know, it's always about saying, you know what, this moment is a new moment and it's a new challenge. And regardless of what I did in the past, doesn't really matter. You know, it's about proving myself now.
And what's the next obstacle in front of you now?
It's really just like, you know, finding that passion. You know, I was a passionate player. You know, I put everything into it, you know, like, in high school, I used to like cry before games, get real teary-eyed, and like I put everything into it. So I want to find something that, you know, moves me, you know, something that helps me be able to live like I'm not working. You know, I want to feel like I'm playing again. So I'm in the process of figuring it out. But I know for a fact it's going to be something along the lines of with kids, like working with kids, probably in with football or just like different school programs to like, you know, help kids out.
Would you want to be a coach?
I would coach like Pop Warner, high school maybe, but I don't want to do like college or NFL.
Yeah, why is that? You think because being around younger kids is closer to your passion?
Yeah, I don't really like the business side of football. You know, I kind of like it when it's still like you're playing football for your friends, you're playing football for the love of it because you're still a kid and it's still a game. It's not a business. It's not hey, you could lose your scholarship if you don't play good. Or, hey, you're injured for 3 weeks. We're going to cut you. You know, like I want to play when it's like about team and, you know, building confidence in these kids and not taking it so serious.
Was there any particular experiences that made you feel like you wanted to get away from the business side of things?
Oh, yeah, the NFL, you know, just the entire way things were, you know, it's just no loyalty. That you'll hear your coach talk bad to you in like the media and smile on your face. And, you know, like I remember one thing that really like turned me off was it was like my second year in the league and Drew Brees was supposed to have a contract, was trying to get a contract extension. And like the front office is putting out stories saying that, oh, Drew Brees isn't that good. Drew Brees is like a middle tier quarterback. We just like work him. We just make it work with our system or whatever, just because they want to pay him less. But every day, you know, when we winning games, oh, Drew Brees the greatest. I love Drew Brees. I wouldn't want to have anybody else. You know, I didn't really like that. They'll manipulate certain things just to get upper edge in business. You know, I like playing for the genuine love of my teammates, love of the game, you know, not really like hey, I'm going to do whatever it takes to win this.
Yeah. When you're playing, like, say you're playing for the Saints, do you feel like your main motivation is like win a Super Bowl for New Orleans and the Saints and the organization? Or is it, I just want to have fun playing football? Or is it, I just love my teammates and we're in this together? Like, what drives you?
Honestly, it's playing my teammates and not letting my teammates down. That's what always drives me, you know? And that's why I equate everything to winning. I want to play as hard as I can, do the right thing, and so everybody be in the right position and I can put my team in a better position to win. You know, I never really cared about individual stats and what it looked like afterwards. I just cared about winning. You know, when I really changed my career and became like a starter in the NFL was when I started being more open with my communication, with telling people what they needed to know, you know, like not hiding any secrets, like letting everybody know whatever they need to know for this play to be successful. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, it's kind of like it's so natural to for your career to focus inwardly and like figure out what's best for you and works for you. But it's almost like once you let that go and you figure out what's best for the, and you work hard to do what's best for the team, that's actually what's most valuable and that's what gets rewarded.
And then you realize when you do what's best for the team, it's also what's best for you too. You know, yeah. Most of the time things come out better for you when you worry about everybody at the same time and more worry about the success of the team than the success of how you played, you know?
Yeah.
I learned that I've been with a lot of talented teams where we're supposed to go to the championship. We're projected in the preseason to have a wild card and, you know, go to the Super Bowl and everything like that. And like we'll play and we'll be terrible because we'll have all the talent, but nobody's playing together. Everybody's playing out, doing their own thing, trying to ball out and have a great game. And then all of a sudden we gave up 40 points, you know, because nobody's communicating. Nobody's trying to play together. Everybody's just trying to do something to make them make a play, you know. And then I've been on teams with less talent and we just communicated. We talked to each other. We made sure we was always on the same page. And we ended up making the playoffs, you know. And we ended up having a lot of success and being a lot of teams we wasn't supposed to beat because we was always on the same page.
Do you think that attitude is pervasive throughout the NFL where there's guys kind of like in it for themselves, more so than, say, college or high school and things like that because of the business side?
Yeah, definitely. And then, like, you know, the media makes it that way. Your team, your GM, the organization makes it that way, you know. Your endorsements make it that way because, you know, everything tells you about selling your brand as a football player. So everybody only thinks about themselves, you know, and then you get contracts where you're only on the team for 1 year or whatever the case may be. So you can't really think about the success of the organization. You kind of just think about yourself and eating, especially because there's a lot of guys that's been cut 3-4 times. That's been on multiple teams in multiple cities and they have a, they're like, yo, I don't care what happens to this team. I'm just going to make this team and make this check, you know. And, you know, you get that because, you know, that a lot of people have been beaten into submission through the NFL having to be selfish because of how they've been treated.
So what do you think? You said you've been in some places where it felt that way. You've been in other places where it sounded like it didn't feel that way. Or maybe that's not true. But what can help contribute to team having that good culture versus that bad culture where people are worried about the team versus worried about themselves?
I think it's what the coaches demand of the players, you know, because we only do what you tell us to do, in a sense. Like if you're a laid back coach that doesn't really care about the details of finishing and technique, when we go in the game, we're not going to go and be the most technically sound team, you know. We're not going to be the ones that's communicating and telling everybody what to do. But when your coach is saying, look, you got to have the best technique out there. You better communicate with your corner. You better communicate with your safety. Y'all better be talking out there. I don't want to see no silence. When the coaches are watching film and say, where's the hand signals? I didn't see you talk to your corner and tell them what the coverage was. Then now you have that team orientation pushed. You know, you have people thinking, all right, now in order for me to keep my job, I have to be able to tell my cornerback what he's doing, because if I don't do that, they're going to take me off the field, you know? So it's about what the coach makes you do, you know?
And you felt like some coaches emphasize that more than others?
Yeah, I think some coaches take for granted that you're just pros. You know, they say, oh, y'all are pros, y'all know what to do. And instead of saying, like, this is what pros are supposed to do, so therefore I'm going to enforce that. You know, like some coaches just say, y'all are grown men, y'all better show up on Sundays and do the right thing. You know, and others say, you know what, all right, this is the right thing and this is how we're going to run our program.
Yeah, I guess in my experience in college football, you don't take any of that for granted. You feel like you have to teach your athletes everything that they need to know because, you know, you don't like trust that they came in with any knowledge from high school. You know, some people do, but some really don't. So you just like, you feel like you teach everyone from scratch. So it doesn't feel that way in the NFL?
No, not at all. Because everybody has a name. Everybody has accolades. Everybody's done something somewhere else, especially the older guys. Like, if you're like year 3 or 4, you come to a new team, they automatically assume you've been through 2 years of being a young guy under a vet and watching them and understanding your routine and getting it together. So by your third, fourth year, there's like, all right, you should be at this level, you know? And if you're not there, then it's like, all right, you're going to get up out of here kind of thing.
Yeah. It's like, they'd rather just, buy or sell the good as is instead of like, teaching yeah. athletes how to be better.
Yeah. I mean, they don't have a lot of time for that. You know, like these coaches always innovate and these players are brand new guys coming in every single day. You know, they don't have time to like say, look, guy, we're going to teach you how to do everything, you know, unless that's what you do. You know, there's certain coaches that take that as the precedent, as no matter how what we're running on in our playbook, as long as we have great technique and we're in shape and we're all communicating, then we'll have a chance to win every single game.
Yeah, I bet that there's applications of that to the real world, you know, like or outside of football, that there's probably a lot of companies and businesses or relationships that that treat it transactionally and probably get a lot less out of it than think of it like developmentally. Yeah. We probably could get a lot more out of it.
Exactly. And that's why my favorite coach was probably Jim Caldwell, because he wasn't about making us football players and, oh, you be the best and make sure you save my job. It was more so like he was trying to raise us to be men. You know, he was teaching us principles in the team meetings. You know, he told us, like, look, we're going to run the same plays. When we start OTAs, when we start training camp, we're going to run the same basic plays so we get all our technique down and we're making sure that you're not thinking and we're just playing football the right way. And I loved him for that because, you know, it was able to transition into real life. You know, these principles are certain things that I still move with today, you know, because it wasn't me. It wasn't just for the sake of winning a football game. It was for the sake of becoming a better person, which will in turn make you a better football player.
Yeah. When did you realize that you had made it, like that you belonged in the NFL, or was it immediate?
I mean, at first it was kind of scary. Like when I made a team, like I told my agent, and he was like, you sure you made the team? Well, don't get an apartment yet, because, you know, they still make cuts a couple days after the last day or whatever. And I'm like, okay. So I'm like on edge until that like first game. And, you know, then even then I'm still like nervous, like, damn, are they going to cut me? Cause it doesn't matter. We lost the game or whatever. And I'm thinking, damn, are they going to cut me? Cause I didn't play good enough or whatever. So I didn't probably get secure in being in the NFL probably till like my fourth year when I got cut from the Saints and went to the Lions.
When like a second team like valued you enough to bring you in?
It was kind of more so like I was able to put in perspective everything I learned about the NFL. You know, New Orleans was crazy and it was absolutely insane. My first year, we went like 13-3 or 12-4, something like that, made the playoffs, went second round of the playoffs, and we ended up losing to like the 49ers in like a crazy way. And then the following year was the Bounty Gate, where Sean Payton got suspended. You know, we didn't have our head coach the whole year. The assistant head coach was suspended for like the first six games, and like the offensive court was it the old line coach was the head coach for like the first six games, and it was just like crazy turmoil. We had like the worst defense in like NFL history statistically or something like that, and you know, we weren't good at all. We was like 7-9, missed the playoffs, and then my third year, I had a high ankle sprain. Fourth preseason game. Thank God they kept me on the team. Like I was injured for like 4 weeks, and I didn't really like. I played after sitting out for 4 weeks. I'm still limping around the field. I'm not as fast as I was before, and you know, they ended up cutting me because of they ended up cutting me during the playoffs because of something crazy. It was like week like 14. We played the Rams. The Rams were they weren't good this year. We were on the way to the playoffs. We was probably looking to get a wild card, and we just had to like win out or something like that. And on a special teams play, the game's already over, we lost. This guy kind of grabbed my teammate's face mask and like started like dragging him like across the field with it. And then like they bumped into me and we hit the ground. So like I pushed the guy off my teammate, and like a big brawl ensued, and like the coach held some resentment towards me from that. And you know, I didn't suit up for the rest of the year, and then I ended up getting cut in the play after our first playoff win, and then that's when I went to the Lions.
Man, you said a lot of stuff there that I have questions about. First thing is I totally forgot that you were in New Orleans during the Bounty Gate deal. First, like, I guess explain what it is to people, and then I'm curious to hear your take as someone like from the inside, like what do people not understand about it, or what could help people understand it better?
The Bounty Gate situation pretty much was that they were saying that we were putting money on players' heads for incentives, or like, you know, you hurt this guy, you'll get paid for this. If you do this, you'll get make some money. So it's like an incentive based play or whatever they were claiming we did. It wasn't. I feel like everything was taken out of context, because the way that everything came about was Steve Gleason. He has ALS. I'm sure you heard of him. He played for the Saints, and he was doing a documentary on himself, and we allowed him into the meeting room the day before we played the 49ers in our second playoff game. And Greg Williams is the defensive coordinator who, like, kind of uses psychology to get you to play, like, as violent and reckless as you can. So, like, he goes to extremes. Like, for instance, this was, like, one of the stories he tells us before a game. He says, like, 50 Muslim terrorists, extremists, were captured by, I can't remember who it was. And it was some group of people, and they were like the Muslim extremists were, you know, bombing and terrorizing these people. So what they did was they killed and bathed 49 of them, and like they killed them like brutally and like bathed them in like pig's blood or something crazy. And then they let one guy go to, like, you know, to tell everybody else to don't mess with them because this is what they'll do to you, you know? So he kind of uses that to get us like in our mindset to play a fast and violent game or whatever. But he doesn't mean it like specifically like, go out there and kill somebody. Like, he'll say things like, go hit him in his knee and tear his ACL. But he's not really telling you to go injure him. He's telling you to play at the level of whatever it takes to win a game, you know? And the filmer of the documentary took it out of context and like kind of brought it to the NFL and then became a whole big thing. But I think it was taken out of context because the entire league does this one thing. And then ESPN did a special on this before, you know? So it was like something that they were saying is specific to us, but it was one thing that was already accepted throughout the NFL and throughout the media, and everybody was okay with it when the special came out, you know. So it was just a tough year because, you know, we had a lot of penalties drawn on us from that. You know, we missed, our coach was gone the entire year, assistant coach was gone the first six games, you know. So it was a whole year of turmoil.
So it's you're saying basically that it's not even true that players were not getting paid to injure players on the other team, that there wasn't like some sort of incentive structure built in?
No, you know, I mean, and if it was, it wasn't something that everybody else was doing. When I was there, there was nothing of the sort. You know, this was like something they were saying came from like 2009 or 2008 when Greg Williams came there. Greg Williams last year was the year I was there. So I think when that clip of him talking about that same story that is told, and then talking about tearing the ACL, I think that's what made the documentary guy kind of go to the NFL, and they started doing more, they started doing, you know, back work and started looking at how they've been. Like, and what was big was the Saints, in this year they went to the Super Bowl, they played the Vikings, and Brett Favre was that quarterback, and they were like absolutely teeing off on Brett Favre. Like, I've never seen a quarterback get hit this much. And they were trying to use that game to say that they were trying to hurt Brett Favre, like, intentionally, and opposed to, like, they were just playing football, and that there was an incentive there for them to hurt Brett Favre.
So you think it's not true, basically, that there was paid, like, people were getting paid for hitting guys?
I don't think, I wouldn't say, it wasn't about it being not true. I think it was about, like, singling out just the Saints for this.
Gotcha.
You know, something that they were completely okay with for years, with every other team doing it. I mean, they had NFL stars on ESPN saying, yeah, I paid my teammate $500 to go hurt this guy, you know, and it was perfectly fine. But, you know, once this came out, a third party said, hey, this is wrong. Then they're like, all right, since the Saints are the team that got caught with it, then we're going to rain down on them so everybody else will stop. So I think it was just more so of like them trying to prove a point to the rest of the NFL saying, don't do this or else you're going to end up with the same penalties as the Saints, you know. So
yeah, I think that rings true to me.
Yeah, I think that was the problem more than whether they were paying players or not. You know, it was just the fact that it was like an alienation of this one of the team.
Yeah, I mean, it's also like it's a sign of the times, you know, in the NFL, and that was 10 years ago, and I think it's even every year since then, and I'm sure for a long time going forward, there's going to be a pacification of NFL football, you know, college football, where things that were once considered part of the culture of playing football are going to be taken out of the game. And, you know, in my mind, probably for the better. You know, you were always a violent physical player, so maybe you have a different thought on that. But I mean, I think that that's where the game is going. And I think that this was just one of those steps where the culture of, you know, for a long time in the NFL, I bet the culture of I'm going to try to hurt a player on the other team, not to ruin his career or anything, but to get him out of that game, to give our team a better chance to win, was part of the culture of playing NFL football. And now that's probably not the truth. You can't do that anymore. And I think that's probably good to say that you can't do that anymore, you know, but anyway, what do you think?
I think that that was a misconception, actually. You know, I think that people weren't going out there. I don't think any player goes out there to try to hurt anybody. And I think that was a problem with Bountygate, was that you couldn't prove that anybody went out there to hurt anybody, because nobody plays like that. You know what I mean? And that's why it makes it seem as though, like, they might have certain guys, like, there was a D-tackle that loved to get slapped before the game. You know, then there's they put these guys in the media in front of everybody and say, this is who the NFL is, these aggressive guys, these guys that, you know, that want to go kill somebody and they're looking for blood. But in reality, 99% of the NFL, they don't want to hurt anybody. You know, nobody ever thinks about, oh, well, shit, if I hurt Brett Favre, man, I get $10,000. You're not thinking that. You know, you're just trying to play football and win a game and, you know, keep it pushing and, you know, work, play for your teammates or whatever. And I think that that's what kind of is the wrong part, because you don't really see players out there going trying to hurt anybody. You know, that nobody ever does that. So I think that's kind of like the misconception with what was actually happening, because, yeah, maybe a coach will say, oh, if you hurt this guy, you'll get this. But nobody's actually doing that. You know, nobody wants to go out there and do that.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I would say, like, it's still, I think there are, players are not in general trying to injure guys on the other team. But I do think, like, you said, you used the word hurt. And I think, like, in my experience, I think that there is a big culture of, you know, wearing down your opponent by making them pay the price to do XYZ, like running back runs. Like, you're not trying to tackle him as softly as possible. You're trying to hit him hard and physical. So the next time, you know, they're a little bit less motivated, a little bit less able to, like, deliver their physicality. And, like, that battle goes on throughout the course of a game. I mean, I think that that's part of it. I mean, like, you're not, I mean, I know you're hitting guys, you're trying to hit them as hard as you can, you know, not to injure them, but, you know, to make them play less aggressively or whatever it is throughout the rest of the game. Don't you think that that's true?
Yeah, but I think that's true throughout all competitive sports, anything that has to do with competition, because there's a part of just playing a game, but also playing the opponent and trying to have an advantage and try to do certain things. Like, for instance, in basketball, it used to be a whole thing to just throw the ball down to Shaq, let him beat this big guy up and score 30 points, you know, because we knew that, oh, you could mentally break this team down if you just continue to pound it away, you know. And I think chess, you know what I mean? So you make certain moves to weaken your opponent. And, you know, I think that's just a part of competition. And football, it just happens to be physical the way you have to break somebody down, you know. So I think it's not necessarily specific to football. It's specific to everything. But the way that it's done in football is just a bit destructive.
Yeah, and I don't think that it's wrong, and I agree with you. It's not a football thing. It's a competition thing, just as you said, that, you know, like, you're trying, there's rules that are black and white that you're trying, that you definitely are trying to stay between, not only because you have to or else you'll get penalized, but also there's, like, a moral ethical thing around them. And then there's some things that are kind of gray, but beyond that, like, you're doing whatever you can to win. That's the whole point. And if that means being physical and reducing your opponent's will, that's part of that. In football, at least, that is definitely part of it.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, the running game, for instance, you know, you hear coaches talk about it all the time, like, look, we're going to beat them up with the running game. We're just going to pound them away with the running game, you know, because it's a way to mentally deteriorate a team. And, like, no defense likes just tackling a running back all day, because that's, like, kind of boring, you know. So it's like, you kind of like, damn, this again. Like, that's what the 49ers did when they went to those string of Super Bowls. They were, like, on a 50 on first and 10 in, like, goal line situation, like, making players, you know, do things that they don't want to do at all. You know, that's like, they broke you down mentally by just having a 340-pound D tackle at fullback blocking for Frank Gore, who's, like, trying to tackle a bowling ball, you know. So it was just like, I don't feel like doing this anymore, you know. And, like, you know, and that's what, like, you know, they just break you down that way, you know.
Well, I think Jim Harbaugh has made a career as a coach with that mentality of
exactly
just wearing out your opponent and making them, like, just not want to play anymore and then rolling over them.
Exactly. You know, and it's a part of the competition, you know, like, that's the almost easiest way to win a game, just to, like, make your opponent not want to play.
Who's the hardest guy in the NFL that you've ever, like, had to tackle that sticks out to you as a guy that you always, like, thought, I don't want to tackle this guy again?
I think it was Frank Gore.
Yeah.
Because I remember I tried to tackle him, and it was like my third or fourth year. And when I hit him, he just kept moving forward, and I needed like five people. Like I hit him pretty sternly too, like where he would at least like stand up or like, you know, stop for a second. But he just slowly kept moving forward. Like I never like, I needed like six people to help me bring him down. I just like went on a ride for like 6 yards, just being dragged by him and stuff like that. Cause he's like so small and compact, and like he's not fast either. So he's just trying to run slow and balanced, and it was impossible to tackle him.
He's like a freight train, you know. He just like, yeah. You know, he just like the momentum just can't get stopped.
Exactly. You need like the rest of the people on your team to, you know, slow him down a little bit.
Well, so now you're done playing, and you don't have any intention of going back, right? You're looking for the next thing now.
Oh yeah, I'm done.
When did that reality set in? Like shortly after you got hurt, or did it take a long time to realize that you weren't going back?
When the doctor told me that I had to have career-ending surgery, that's when it really like set in and made me realize like, wow, it's over.
Yeah, and then you were living in Miami at the time, I imagine, right?
Yep.
And did you decide to stay down in Florida, or where are you at now?
Oh yeah, I'm back and forth. I bought a house in Florida, so I still live in Florida a lot, and but I'm also in New York now because I go to a rehab center in White Plains that's been helping me out a lot.
I see. And so you're still doing rehab, you know, pretty, you know, a lot, I guess.
Oh yeah, every day.
And then how does that work? Like, does the NFL pay for your injury at all? Or I imagine there must be some level of insurance that the NFL covers, right?
Yeah, they do. But, you know, it's a battle with insurance companies, you know, going back and forth and trying to prove the case of why you need certain treatments and had to see certain doctors and stuff. So, you know, it's still a business. It's not just like all cut and dry.
Yeah. Does it feel like you're battling the NFL? Does it feel like you battle whatever insurance the NFL has?
No, I feel like I'm battling the NFL because, I mean, they know what they put in place to, you know, for this to happen. And it's like messed up. You know, they've denied me different like appointments for doctors, you know, trying to say I had to pay for it. And it's like, you know, like I'm completely done playing football, trying to get my body together. But they're saying, well, there's no documented evidence that you got hurt doing this in a game. So therefore, we're not paying for it, you know, and it's like, that makes no sense, you know.
yeah, your arm is paralyzed because you just turned 30 years old, and that's what happens. That's their stance.
Exactly, and they try to make it seem, well, you don't really need it, so therefore we're not paying for it, and you just got to keep fighting and keep fighting and keep fighting, and it's very draining, I could say.
Yeah, do you get help with that? Like, I imagine you had an agent at one point, and you probably had some level of support. Is it kind of like they're all dried up and gone and moving on to the next person, or do they still feel like they're a part of your life?
Oh no, my support system is still strong. I mean, even the Dolphins still like behind me 100%. You know, so I still talk to my agent all the time. I have disability lawyers that help me like with the battle of the NFL and everything like that. So I feel I have a really strong support system around me still.
That's nice. Do you feel like that your exit from the NFL, as far as like how you've been able to handle it and move on, you know, like start to work to move on to the next thing and like be set up in a place where you're financially, you know, I think pretty secure. Is that, you think, pretty typical for NFL guys, or do you think that you've done things differently?
I think it's especially my situation, like being hurt while playing and still being like financially stable and secure. Like it was very rare. So like, you know, I feel like a lot of players, they have that loss of identity, especially the guys that don't have to work ever again and that set their lives up the right way. Oftentimes the guys that, you know, spend a lot of money, when they retire, they go get a job to make some more money because they're always spending. But like I think the guys that, like, you know, make some money, can live comfortably, retire playing football, that the toughest part is finding that passion again, finding something that you really want to do again, you know? And I feel like a lot of guys in the NFL deal with that. And it's probably the toughest time too, because that's when you're most alienated from the world. You know, like you don't have your teammates to go around to, you don't see football players every day anymore. So now you're just like the unicorn NFL athlete that made millions of dollars, you know, and you're the only person there. And it's tough to think that, you know, your problems aren't exclusive to you, and you're the only person, you know, that has to deal with what you're dealing with.
Yeah, do you get like, is there some sort of support system that you have, like just from former teammates or recent teammates that are going through things that are similar to you?
Yeah, actually, when in May, this past May, I went to this recovery center in California where there was a bunch of NFL ex-NFL athletes that had different injuries and a lot of brain injuries, a lot of different things. And we were able to connect on certain things we went through in the NFL. And at that time, I didn't really have many people to talk to that could like relate to what I've been dealing with, like coming from being injured in the NFL and everything like that. So it helped out a lot just to be around guys that retire, that are injured, that fighting with the NFL, that's been screwed over by the NFL, and just having like a brotherhood there. And then also the director of player personnel for the Dolphins, he started a company called ATU, Athletes Transition U, where he tries to get former and current athletes to like start worrying about what they're gonna do after football, So he does this thing called a business combine every year, where he brings a bunch of guys from the NFL out to New York, and we meet with different like big time businesses that and they tell us their success story, and we like build our networks based on what we want to do and what we're interested in. So I've when it comes to like second career things, I've been able to find different people to relate to on that, So like I've been it's tough, it's still tough, but I feel like I'm in a much better place knowing I'm not alone doing this.
Yeah, there's just like a lot of, it seems like a lot of battles for someone in your position. I mean, there is the fact that you spent whatever, more than 25, close to 30 years, preparing yourself for this one career that is now clearly like not happening any longer. You still have a long ways to go before you're like probably gonna sail off into the sunset and retire. And so like that is like challenge one. Challenge two is, I think maybe less you than others, but some of them, like, they never like even thought about the fact that they might not play football one day. And all they knew they were going to the NFL from their first day in college, right? Whereas for you, it's probably a little bit different story. You probably prepared yourself a little bit more. And then there's also like most people don't have to get used to doing the thing that they love the most for good money, like that being their job for 5 years or whatever it might be, 10 years if you're lucky, and then go have to like settle to do something that you're going to get paid way less for and will be l way less fun. It's like that whole thing hitting you all at once. It's got to be a lot.
Yeah, it's tough. I've been saying a lot recently, like this is like new territory for like not many professions. You could retire in your 20s or 30s, be financially stable, and have to find something else to love. You know what I mean? Because you're so young, so like it's tough to like try to like put yourself into something like you put yourself into football, because it was such a full body emotional experience more than it was just going out there and playing some games, So the toughest part is just figuring out what to do next, or and also coming to grips with the fact that that probably will never be fulfilled again. You're never gonna feel like that again, and like being okay with that. So it's just it's a lot of growth in there. Like it's tough to be like a 30-year-old rookie again. Where you got to learn life again and figure out your place in the world. And because you can't be a football player anymore, you got to be as a human.
Yeah, and you have like a financial head start, but if you want to live like a good lifestyle, like you're probably not financially set for life. You probably still need to work and make money if you want to maintain some level of a lifestyle. I mean, I don't know, each NFL player when they grad, when they finish is like in a little different spot there, but for a lot of NFL players, that's probably true.
Oh yeah, definitely. But I made sure I came in the NFL with a financial goal to make a certain number. And I definitely hit that number, so I'm like I could live my quality of life, throughout it, because I had that goal. I went in the NFL saying, well, I remember the actual day. I was maybe like the fourth game of the season, and like nobody in the building knows me because one, I'm a quiet guy, and then two, I'm brand new. So it was like after practice, during lunch, right before meetings, where like you get some free time and stuff like that. And I was like walking in the hallway, and then one of like the older coaches, he's probably been in the league since like the 70s, and he seen me walking. He called me in his office, and he was telling me like, "Look, you put $4 million in an account and make 5%. That's 200,000 a year. You better be able to live off of 200,000." So I made sure I set my career up to get there, so I don't wouldn't ever have to work again. I got there, and it worked out.
Well, yeah, I mean that's great. I imagine that that's probably not true for a lot of NFL guys. Do you think that NFL players, I mean, there's a reputation I think out there that NFL players, like squander their money and they end up being broke by the time they leave the league and they have nowhere to go. Do you think that that's like a thing of the past or not even was ever really that true? Or what do you think about that?
I think that the awareness is coming up because the first thing, like when you were around, when you get to the NFL, you get this big contract. You don't really get like a support system from the team to tell you what to do and like teach you how to do what to do with your money and stuff like that. You go like you get a bunch of yes men, you know, a bunch of guys that say, hey, I can take your money and turn it into this. Hey, you need a manager. Hire me. Hey, you need this. Hey, you need that. You know, so like at first, I think a lot of guys were just being pulled into being high class consumers where they got millions of dollars and now they're just spending millions because they have this network of people just telling them to, hey, you're worth this. You need to be doing this. You need to be doing that. But then now a lot of the directors of player personnel is a lot of like, you know, former players are kind of pushing this financial literacy and trying to raise these guys to be men instead of giving these 22-year-old kids $20 million and say, go have a good life, you know, where you're going to get used because, you know, most of these guys came from poverty, never had anything and never knew what to do with a dollar. So they're going to trust these people that been had money their entire life. And they're going to, they say, oh, you do what I do, you'll be a million, you'll have even more millions or whatever the case may be, you know, and, you know, it's a, I think that the narrative is starting to change and people are starting to be a lot smarter with their money, opposed to just trusting people that been in the position before.
Yeah. And what'd you study in college?
Accounting and finance.
Okay, so like you're probably a little bit better suited to make those smart decisions than probably your average, you know, NFL player.
Yeah, definitely. You know, because a lot of guys, you know, people don't know what $1 million is. You know, some guys still think like $1 million is like endless money. Like you can spend whatever you want, and you know, you'll still have a lot of money left after you have the time of your life. You know, and a lot of people learn it the hard way, and that's the sad part.
What was your first big purchase, if you had any?
I bought a car because my rookie year, I drove an 05 Camry the entire year, my mother's car. Because I didn't have no time to get a car, get my life in order, really. So like I waited till that off season to buy a car because I also wanted to see how many checks I got for the year because I made the opening day roster, it wasn't a lock for me to, you know, be on the team the entire year. So I wanted to make sure I got every dollar that I was supposed to get and then made a big purchase. I got a Audi A7.
Nice. And did you feel like that was like a gift to yourself or like kind of having made it at least at one level?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because I started off, I was going to get an Audi A6, but we made the playoffs. And I'm like, all right, if we win the first playoff game, I'm just going to upgrade because we get playoff checks. So like, you know, I was like, all right, we won the first playoff game. Like, you know what? I'm about to treat myself, you know? So it was a reward to say, damn, like you really did it. Like just 6 months ago, you were just on your couch chilling, doing nothing. And now like you made enough money to buy yourself a car and still be very, very comfortable, you know?
And when you were a player and you were going out, did it feel like you could go out and not get noticed? Or was it like people saw you and they're like, oh, that's Issa Abdul El-Qaddous. He plays for the Saints, you know, or, you know, anything like that. Or how did that feel? Was that like something that hit you?
It depends who I was with. You know, I wasn't really a familiar face, but like, you know, if it was a bunch of us, even if we weren't familiar faces, they could just tell like, oh, these guys are in the NFL, you know? And then, you know, like sometimes there were like certain places where Saints players will always go. So like people will know you there and stuff. And then, you know, same thing with Detroit and Miami.
And is that a feeling that you relish or that you try to avoid being recognized as being an NFL player?
I don't really like having it in the forefront, you know, because I don't really identify as just a football player. Now, I just want to talk about football player and being a football player and live through the lens of being a football player. So, like, I don't really tell people most of the time, but, I don't mind it because sometimes it's like you have a good conversation, you know, you meet some decent people.
And did you find it hard, you know, with your friends that you grew up with or people that you went to college with? Maintaining relationships as your life changed or you know, you're a pretty level-headed guy, so I imagine less than some, but I could just imagine that some friends would get jealous or like controlling or, you know, all sorts of like weird reactions to having a friend, you know, make it in the way that you did. Did you have to deal with anything like that?
No, I don't think so because I feel like the friends I've always had around me were people that we were just friends. It was never like a competition, like, oh, I'm better than you. Oh, I should be doing that. You know, I feel like we've always been genuinely happy for whatever everybody was doing, you know. So I had more support more than anything, you know, from my friends and like people coming out, because like I was in cities by myself, like New Orleans and Detroit and Miami, and I've had friends come out there, you know, drive out there and, you know, just to visit me and like to look out and stuff. So I didn't have to deal with that at all, really.
And, you know, listening to this podcast, we have a lot of high school athletes and their parents and coaches. You know, coming from where you came from, you know, being basically like a not getting like a true athletic scholarship coming out of high school, you know, really only one school offering any sort of scholarship, you know, one AA school that wasn't, you know, at the time at least wasn't very good. And then, you know, becoming an undrafted rookie free agent and then having a long career in the NFL, like what advice would you have for someone that's a high school athlete or a parent or anything like that?
What I would say is that, you know, the narrative is going to speak for itself in the future. I think you just got to keep putting your head down and working, you know, and just whatever you have, you got to make the best situation out of it. You know, my dream and my idea of what college is going to be like, I thought it was going to be at one of these big schools and, you know, on full scholarship, you know, getting the primetime treatment, you know, but, you know, reality was I was at Fordham where they didn't even care about us having a football team, you know, so like, I just made it work. You know, you got to just like continue to keep pushing forward. You don't like go into a depressive state and say, well, my dream is over because it's not the way I thought it was going to be. You know, you got to just make work with what you have.
Well, I think if you keep that attitude, you know, for yourself and for others, you know, a lot of success will come of it. So thanks for taking the time and being on the podcast and, you know, giving us all your stories and your wisdom. I'd love to have you back on again sometime. Would you be up for that?
Oh, yeah, I would love that, man. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this.
All right, man. Issa, take care. I'll talk to you again soon.
All right, man. You too.
All right. I love having a guy like Issa on. He certainly has some unique athletic ability. But his power to control his own mind and his discipline to turn good thinking into good action, that's what he built his NFL career on. Excited to see what he does next. So thanks for listening. And if you find our content valuable, please consider donating on our Patreon page at patreon.com/verifiedathletics. You can also support us by sharing this podcast with people you know. It is support from listeners like you that make it possible to continue to provide helpful and free content. Thanks again. Bye.